Welcome to Ricochet's Political Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Pethakoukas of the American Enterprise Institute, The Week Magazine, and CNBC. Each week, the podcast features a lively conversation with top thinkers and doers on the most important and interesting economic and policy issues of our time. Archived episodes can be found at ricochet.com and follow-up blog posts and transcripts at aei.org.
My guest today is political analyst Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington. You might be familiar with his writings in National Review, Weekly Standard, National Affairs, and many other fine publications. He's on the podcast today to chat about his new book, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. Henry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.
In the book, you describe a sort of a populist blue-collar Reaganism, one that you say is sort of about interpreting the New Deal rather than repealing and replacing it. But it's sort of a view that might seem at odds to both the conservatives and liberals. An alternate title might be maybe the Reagan you never knew, or Reagan, you're all wrong about him. You have folks on the right who might see Reagan as sort of the ultimate conservative who got government off our backs. Folks on the left would see him as maybe ushering in Wall Street, decade of greed, the decline of the working class. So I think neither side might view him in the way you're framing him. So why are you framing him in this way? Sort of almost a Springsteen-like character, I guess, a blue-collar conservative.
Well, yeah, I'm framing him that way because that's who he was. That I walked into this trying to, as I say in the introduction to the book, trying to figure out how the Republican Party and the conservative movement could find its way again after the debacles of 2006 and 2008 that had reduced Republican strength to the lowest since before the Reagan election. And what I learned is everything that I knew about Reagan was wrong, that there's an unholy alliance between the progressive left and the libertarian right to portray Ronald Reagan as somebody who thinks that government ought to do nothing except hire police and run roads and national defense. And in fact, it's absolutely not what Ronald Reagan was. It's not what Ronald Reagan said. It's not what Ronald Reagan supported. Ronald Reagan was somebody who never supported as a conservative the sort of government-centric society that the progressive left wants, or government-directed society, but always supported the basic innovations of social welfare that FDR brought in. And that's why I say that he interpreted rather than opposed FDR, because he was never part of the let's throw FDR and the New Deal out wholesale that the right was and in some respects still is.
And is that really sort of where the key error is made, is misinterpreting Reagan's relationship with the New Deal on both sides, and how did that happen? How did that, both those sort of stereotypes on the left and the right about, well, Reagan sort of be?
I think it's because both people saw him through the lenses that they view American life. That for the progressive, the only true heir to the New Deal is the people who want to push it to its limits. That they had this battle in 1948 over the soul of the New Deal, with Henry Wallace breaking off to form his own new party and the Democrats being a more reformist version of that. But that battle in the Democratic Party has continued on to this day. That's still the fight between the Clinton wing and the Sanders wing as to what the New Deal means. Is it a reforming impulse, or is it a recasting of America? And the libertarian right saw Reagan as somebody who was willing to stand up for one of their own and didn't listen carefully to Ronald Reagan's words. They were so happy to have somebody who talked about the principles of freedom in a way that people didn't recoil from, that they overlooked and continued to overlook throughout his life the ways in which he fundamentally disagreed with them. And they often would shake their head and say it's his aides around him or it's political circumstances. But the fact is, when you look carefully at his ideas, it was the man himself. The man himself was not someone who wanted to throw out everything that had been passed since 1932.
But is it just sort of the libertarian right that gets Reagan wrong, or is it more broad? Could you also throw in everybody from Heritage Foundation to National Review to, you know, it's very, very broadly, have they all sort of gotten Reagan?
Well, I think one of the things about they have also gotten Reagan wrong, but I think one of the things is that conservatism remains unreconciled as to what it is for. in 1964 when Reagan gave his famous speech that made him a star for Barry Goldwater. This is chapter three of my book, is a careful deconstruction of that speech.
Right.
Reagan launches into many attacks.
Is that the Rendezvous with Destiny speech?
It's the Rendezvous with Destiny speech. Right. He called it a time for choosing,
right.
but
right.
it's known for the
right.
Rendezvous, which is itself an FDR line
right.
that he picked up. But after attacking government, he says that the liberal do-gooders always say that we're against something. They never say we're for anything. And then he says what conservatives are for. And he doesn't say conservatives are for liberty. He doesn't say conservatives are for civil society. He doesn't say conservatives are for the Constitution. He says conservatives are for a limited Social Security, telling senior citizens that they shouldn't have to, they should get needed medical care from the government if they don't have enough money. That he's for the United Nations, but against some of the excesses, and he's for foreign aid. The four things he says conservatives are for are all things that either were spawned by the New Deal or put into the desire for them was spawned by the New Deal. So I don't see how you can read that and say that Ronald Reagan was not crafting a conservative populism that was both interpreting FDR but also bringing the best of conservatism into this new blend of a new philosophy that, in fact, is what the majority of Americans wanted.
But do you think there were significant differences between sort of candidate, governor and candidate Reagan, the Reagan of sort of the mid-60s through the 70s and the Reagan as president?
No, I don't think there were. Certainly Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan didn't think there were. And as Nancy Reagan, and I quote in the book, is saying that Ronnie.
The supply side bit came later. I mean, that
well, but that, was, first, Ronald Reagan never said he was a supply sider. Ronald Reagan, in private letters and in his autobiography, said that people have said that I'm a supply sider. I never understood what Simon Pure supply side was, and I never agreed with it in all of its principles. The other fact is that Ronald Reagan was talking about lowering tax rates as a way to spur economic growth before any of the supply-siders were out of college. He was talking about specific tax cut plans in 1958, 1961, 1962, supported by a conservative Democrat congressperson named Herlong. And the last version that he cited had Howard Baker, who was then a freshman representative from Eastern Tennessee, as the Republican co-sponsor, the Herlong-Baker tax bill. Reagan talked about indexing tax brackets for inflation in 1962. He talked about lowering the top rate to below 50% in 1962. He talked about all of the things that became supply side, with the exception of the focus on the entrepreneur, which was never part of Reagan's focus. But all of the core elements of supply side, Reagan was talking about it before supply side was even dreamed up.
Right. So so you're presenting do you like the word populist?
Yeah. I do.
That's okay. All right. So it's sort of a more populist Reaganism than perhaps we remember. And again, how did given that again, if you talk to progressives, again, I'm sure they'd say this is ridiculous. You do not have a blue collar Reagan. This it was a tool of the elites, the tool of corporate America. The Gordon Gekko decade of greed. And to the extent he was, a blue-collar president or blue-collar conservative, is a purely maybe a rhetorical thing. But in policy-wise, how did that manifest itself during the Reagan presidency?
Well, during the Reagan presidency, first, it manifests itself that he was cutting taxes for everybody.
Right.
He cut tax rates for everybody. He indexed inflation, the brackets for inflation. When he did his tax reform, he also increased the personal exemption so that millions of people were removed from the tax rolls entirely, and all families, all individuals got a tax break even if their rates didn't come down very much. Is on respect to programs, he always said that people who were truly needy were not going to be subject to cuts. So that meant that Ronald Reagan exempted the bulk of Social Security. Ronald Reagan exempted Medicare. Ronald Reagan exempted Medicaid from cuts. If you food stamps were not significantly cut during Reagan's era. If you were somebody who was receiving a government benefit and you were at or below the median income in Ronald Reagan's presidency, you were highly unlikely to be subjected to a single dime in loss or threatened loss to your benefits. And that's because he understood that people had made their expectations, and they needed those benefits. Whether he would have supported a program as large as it was, by the time he was president, he said, this is part of our fabric. We're going to maintain our national commitment to these people. And so you had both a president who was trying to create jobs and increase private sector opportunity, who was giving tax cuts to everybody, not just the top 1%, and protecting people at or below the median income from cuts in their benefits.
And even though perhaps, as you would put it, you know, the right-wing libertarians don't seem to recognize this, and the progressives don't seem to recognize it, obviously, you think the voters, white working class, particularly those voters, recognize that they saw him as on their side.
Absolutely.
And they
saw him on their side from as soon as he became governor, that when he ran for governor, we've just been through a presidential election where people are marveling how Donald Trump improved the margins in counties by 10 or 20 or 30% over Mitt Romney. Ronald Reagan in working class towns in Southern and Northern California improved the margins over the previous Republican nominee by 40%. He got working class support in 1966. He kept it in 1970. When he ran for president, every time he was the benefit in primary and in the general election of dramatic numbers of working class Southern and Midwestern and Northeastern ethnic Democrats in the Northeast and the Midwest who came over and voted for him. They saw their champion in Ronald Reagan, not in the progressive-dominated Democratic Party, but certainly not in either the elite, moderate country club Republicanism or the anti-government Goldwater conservatism. They saw Reagan as their guy.
Right, and that white working-class group of voters, you paint that as sort of the key electoral group, and as that group sort of shifts back and forth over the decades, that explains why we get this way, why Republicans sort of lost the presidency, why Democrats gained the presidency. I wonder if you could just walk through that just for a minute or two on the importance of that group, because it wasn't so long ago here. I was hearing that, you know, what was important were the ascendant groups, you know, Hispanics in particular, but the white working class. That's we've seen that to be the key group, and I guess you think that they will continue to be a key electoral group, at least in.
Yeah, I mean, I'll keep it short because that's the last chapter of my book, which is the longest chapter in my book. But ever since 1896, the white working class, particularly in the Midwest, is the group that decides who wins the presidency and who forms a national coalition. And in part, at first, it was because of their sheer size. You know, there was a time when 80% of America was white working class and maybe 40% of them were in factories. But even today, nearly 40% of American voters are white working class. They dominate the Midwestern states. And we saw this come to fruition with Donald Trump's election, where Donald Trump did not win among the so-called ascendant classes.
Right.
He lost suburban support from Mitt Romney, but he became president because he recovered the Reagan magic among this group. And this group is concentrated in the five Midwestern states that only Trump has carried since Ronald Reagan: Iowa, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Only Reagan and Trump have carried those states in the last 40 years for the Republican Party, and it's because they were the only people to speak directly to the aspirations, hopes, and realities of everyday life of the white working class factory person or semi-skilled laborer.
And Republicans, Republicans or Democrats, when they fail to do that, they lose. So
right.
How did Republicans start failing to do that? How did the brilliant strategists in 1989 not look back at the previous, you know, 8 years and think, oh, these are the lessons we've drawn. These are how we need to apply them going forward. How did they not understand those lessons?
Very few, if any, of Republican candidates actually come from a white working class, non elite Protestant background. They look down on the people silently. They think that if you're not an entrepreneur or a business person, you're not making it in society. And so they're always talking in a way that is alien to these people. Ronald Reagan was the son of Catholic working class people. Donald Trump was somebody whose employees were these people throughout his career. So they had a natural affinity with them. But the country club Republican and the libertarian Republican have a disdain for government benefits, and they have a disdain for government activity, and it comes through. They did not learn all of the lesson. They thought Reagan had given them a cookie-cutter formula: cut taxes, build a strong military, talk about social issues, and that's how you get it. But they would do all those things and continually lose because that wasn't what Ronald Reagan had given us.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Thousands of people seeking home security get ripped off every day by getting locked into long-term contracts. Now there's a smarter way to protect your home, SimpliSafe Home Security. SimpliSafe was built by a Harvard-educated engineer after his best friends were victims of burglary. All their possessions were stolen. His friends obviously wanted to get home security, but they were renters and not allowed to install the wired system. So he created a brand new system, wireless, portable, easy to install, and with no long-term contracts. Here's why SimpliSafe is a better choice. SimpliSafe has no annual contracts. Get professional 24/7 professional monitoring starting at just $14.99 per month. No activation, installation, or hidden fees. Built-in cellular signal, which is faster, safer, and less expensive than a landline. User-friendly wireless design and easy do-it-yourself installation. It's unbeatable protection, a great value, and there's no contracts. Go to simplisafe.com/ricochet right now, and you'll also get free shipping on your order and a free keychain remote worth $25. It only takes a minute to get started. Visit simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com/ricochet.
And we're back talking with Henry Olson about his new book, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. Before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about how Republicans failed to learn that lesson. If there was sort of a moment of maybe peak failure to learn that lesson, was it perhaps the 2012 election when I was at that convention? I think I was with U.S. News and World Report at the time, and of course that was a convention. You didn't build that. It was a very entrepreneur, business focused theme, which according to your book, at least in the way you're looking at things, completely missed the point of what they need to do in 2012 to win that election from Barack Obama.
Absolutely, that was if not peak failure, peak obviousness of the failure, because here you had a president who in his 3 years in office had alienated the white working class. They were the backbone of the 2010 wave that gave Republicans control of Congress again and gave Republicans all the state houses that they currently occupy. And instead of nominating somebody or crafting a message that would appeal to them, they created the anti-blue-collar candidate. They put somebody who was the boss you never liked, who talked in a language that the blue-collar worker despised, and you had people who faced with choice between the devil that they didn't like in Obama and the devil that they didn't like in Romney, understood that the Democratic platform ultimately was one that would not throw them to the wolves, whereas they believed and have always believed that entrepreneurial, management-focused Republicanism doesn't care about the working man.
But these are voters who they liked what they saw in Barack Obama in 2008, voted for him again in 2012. But fell out of love with the president. And I'm not sure I understand why, based on your book, because it seems like he did a lot for the work. We had a recession, so we had this big stimulus plan to get us out of the recession. Healthcare, Obamacare. Had Dodd-Frank went after the banks, so we wouldn't have another financial crisis. Why wasn't that Obama agenda popular with those voters?
Well, I think we're finding now that as Republicans talk about repealing Obamacare, that the extension of health care benefits is popular with them. Right. But what they saw was a president who didn't make their issues in it a priority. They didn't feel anything from the stimulus. Jobs continued to leave. Their wages didn't go up. The recovery was mainly coastal and suburban. It wasn't reaching down to these workers. So after 8 years, they had been told that things were going to get better for them, and they had been suffering during the Bush years.
Right.
And so they had 16 years of orthodox Republicans saying, if you cut taxes, business will come to your community. Instead, business left. And you had 8 years of orthodox Democrats saying, if you regulate the economy and increase taxes, business will come back to your community. And that didn't happen. And they turned to somebody who said, well, you know what the problem is? The problem is the elites who don't care about you or understand you, and I'm going to try something different. And they loved Donald Trump.
Right. I'm wondering if is another way of looking at this is rather than making sure you have rhetoric that appeals to white working class voters, or coming up with specific policies that seem to address their needs. I mean, at least if you go back to the Reagan years, isn't it just important to be president when the business cycle just goes your way? Doesn't that really explain a lot of this? I mean, with Reagan, he's lucky he inherited. They had a recession at the very beginning, so then he had a big bounce back. So he had a big drop and a big bounce back. Bush, weak economy. Then you had Clinton started off weak, had a weak economy at the beginning, but then he had the tech boom. So then you know, he looks like a miracle worker. Bush, weak economy. Obama finally was elected based on an economy that was collapsing, but then had a very weak recovery, so he fell out of favor. So isn't another way just looking at, like, just you have to get lucky as president to wherever the business cycle is, and that really explains a lot of this rather than your rhetoric or specific policies that make it seem to workers like that you care about them?
Yeah, no, I think you need both. I mean, certainly you shouldn't discount the role of luck or the business cycle and things, but candidates who don't appeal to the people who are up for grabs don't get the people who are up for grabs. And I think that's the lesson of 2012, is that you had people who had not – who by 2012 were still not coming back to work in significant numbers. The recovery was weak, and it was still focusing at that time on more highly skilled workers. They were – when you talked to Republican strategists at the time, they all thought these voters were locks because their economy was so bad that they would – and they didn't like the president's priorities, that they'd vote for anybody. And that wasn't true. It wasn't true because elections, presidential elections, are about choices. And when they take a look and they say, the choice that this person has, I don't think will make things better – they'll reluctantly stick with somebody even if that person hasn't succeeded for them. And I think that's what the lesson of 2012 was that you can't rely on the business cycle, or you can't rely on external circumstances. You actually have to persuade people that your alternative is something that you can trust. And that's what Ronald Reagan was able to do in spades. And Reagan also was able to do well in his race for governor when the business cycle had nothing to do with it. I mean, certainly in 1966, the business was booming. There's no reason to abandon the Democratic Party from a business cycle standpoint. But yet he completely swept and won a million vote victory, 20 percentage point victory on the back of working class voters who just felt that he represented them.
How come Republicans did not look at, and this is, and it's a number I've quoted a lot, was not surprised to see it in the book, the exit poll after the 2012 election, which looked at for voters who thought it was important to have a president who cared about them, who showed them empathy. I have this number wrong, and I'm pretty sure that Obama beat Romney by about 1-0. It may have been like 80.
It was 81 to 18.
Or something like that. But it might as well
have been 1-0.
Right. So that to me was such a screaming number that it just was that Republicans just didn't need like sort of a slightly different packaging, that there's something deeply missing from the Republican message to a lot of voters But that was not the conclusion a lot of Republicans drew, because the Republican autopsy was very, which you write a bit about, offered a different sort of roadmap to recapturing the presidency.
Right. Well, I mean, in 1964, when Ronald Reagan was deconstructing the Goldwater debacle, he said, human nature resists change and it bends over backwards to resist radical change. Right. And I don't think I'm calling for radical change, but given people's on the Republican side self-understanding, I am calling for change. And it was very easy for Republicans of all stripes to say the problem was the man, the problem wasn't our message. We don't have to change. Right. And that was the reaction of all wings of the party. I go into this in the book that I say that the Ted Cruz wing adopted what I call louder and clearer conservatism, right, that we just have to be more forceful about how much we don't like government and aspects of the New Deal. And the autopsy and the establishment had what I call clothes and cosmetics conservatism, which is change a couple of things on the outside, effectively put on some new clothes and, you know, little nicer cosmetics to make yourself look better, and the same package can fly. No. You can't put lipstick on a pig. Right. For these voters, what the establishment Republicans want to sell them is a pig, and they won't accept it. And you saw it with Donald Trump, is that he gave them something new. He gave them something that echoed exactly what they thought in worldview and on issue after issue. And it was outside either group's orthodoxy, the louder and clearer orthodoxy, or the clause and cosmetic orthodoxy. And not only was what the general electorate wanted, it's what the Republican Party wanted. So these people were completely out of touch. They let their ideological blinders and their resistance to change blind them to what voters wanted. And it's no different from a business that continually ignores market signals to send out products that people don't want because they just can't bring themselves to change.
Right. You don't have much good to say about sort of Ted Cruz style conservatism, that he has a sort of a deep misunderstanding of Reagan.
No one quotes Reagan more and understands him less.
But also sort of, you know, Ryan style Paul Ryan Republicanism, which sort of moved from, I think maybe you call it the sort of kind of austerity wing, worried a lot about debt and deficits. But then Ryan began focusing on the poverty issue. But of course, that misses the point too, because that's also not the voters that they need to get. It was sort of that broad middle class that felt the Republican Party just, you know, what was not offering anything tangible that would change their lives.
Yeah.
Sort of meaning.
What I say in the book is that you should always look at your policies and your political worldview through what I call the truckers and cashiers test.
Right.
If you didn't graduate from college and you're a guy, the likeliest job that you have is a trucker. And if you're a woman, you're either a waitress or a cashier. And the question is, when they're listening to you on the radio, do they hear things that you're talking about that resonate with the realities of their life? So when Paul Ryan shifts from, well, I basically want to shrink governments so that if maybe we can't drown it in the bathtub, but we can drown it in the shower,
right.
But to I care about the poor, he completely jumps over these people. And he's talking about how he cares about other people, but not these people. And that, too, completely misses the boat. And you could see it in the way that people who talked about poverty in the campaign, in the primary campaign, completely missed the boat as far electorally, because that's not what people who are working class are worried about. They don't consider themselves poor to the extent they're afraid of being poor. They're not thinking about government programs. They're thinking about things like, hey, the reason I might be poor is because these Chinese are manipulating their currency to take my job. What are you going to do about that?
Right. Romney actually did mention the Chinese currency issue, interestingly, during that.
Very cautiously, and he was always attacked from the Wall Street Journal editorial page for departing from free market orthodoxy.
Right. So we have Donald Trump, who certainly the rhetoric made it very clear, I'm sort of fighting for you. You've been screwed by the elites message. And then he also had policies, which polling suggested might be very popular. But since they were sort of counter to sort of traditional GOP economic orthodoxy, no one else was saying that. Is there a risk here that the Republican Party to follow sort of Trumpism and get those voters and now keep those voters ends up embracing a set of policies which are ultimately not very good policies and are policies which maybe are a mismatch for the actual problems? Because reforming Medicare and Social Security may not be good politics, but we kind of need to do it in some way. And we're not going back to sort of a pre-globalization world. That's not happening. And we're probably not going to become a wealthier country by, you know, having less trade. So are Republicans locking themselves now into a set of policy to keep those voters, which long-term aren't very good economic policies?
Well, I think what the Republican Party needs to do is do what Reagan did, which is stop being bound by your ideology and be bound by principles and be more flexible. That the Republican approach to reforming entitlements is treating it like a fiscal problem. You know, we'll cut the government's contribution and hope that you can do well, rather than understanding that it's a sacred obligation. Why can't we reform medical, Social Security and Medicare by focusing the way Reagan would have on who needs it, as opposed to treating it like a budget exercise?
Right.
And with respect to things like trade, I don't think we should become Fortress America and protectionist. But on the other hand, first of all, if there are countries that are using their unfairly competing with us through currency manipulation or blocking exports or subsidizing imports, we should retaliate. Reagan did multiple times. You know, he was for free trade, but also for fair trade. But we also need to think, okay, we have a global oversupply of labor in the lower skilled areas. If we're going to have free trade, that will open many of our citizens up to competition that they likely can't win. How are we going to deal with this?
Right.
In a way that doesn't treat them like collateral damage from our pursuit of wealth. That's the real problem. And a Republican Party that can deal with that is one that can keep trade and deal with the effects of trade. But a Republican Party that wants to go back to, well, you know, all people are is a cipher on a budget ledger.
Right.
Is a Republican Party should expect not to have the public confidence to be able to do the reforms we
right.
need.
But, you know, is sort of what you see as sort of the misinterpretation of Reagan, is that just still so deeply ingrained into the party that it will take sort of years before those people sort of, you know, die off and people have a different view? And I think what was the most popular book on the right a couple years ago? It was a book on Coolidge, on Calvin Coolidge, and people hearkening back. And in fact, when Republicans are talking about the tax rates they want to go back to, we have to go back to the Coolidge era tax rates. So, I mean, what kind of response have you got to your interpretation of Reagan as an interpreter of the New Deal when there are still so many Republicans who think that
we
need to repeal the New Deal?
Yeah, well, that's the problem, is that you've got a very large group of intellectual conservatives who really do want to repeal the New Deal. And by writing this book, I call them out on it. You know, let's actually talk about this. Do you really, in your heart of hearts, think that instead of using weasel words like the progressive era, do you really think that Social Security was a violation of the Constitution? Your grandfathers did. That's what they said in 1955 and 1965. Do you? And if you don't, then you're an interpreter of Franklin Roosevelt, just like Ronald Reagan, just like me. Where do you stand on this? But I think Donald Trump's victory shows that the Republican voter is not in line with the Republican ideologue. The Coolidge book, The Forgotten Man, may have been popular among an intellectual elite.
Right.
But when I get out and talk to average Republicans, they love this stuff because that actually is where they are, as opposed to where the elites in Washington think they ought to be.
Right. And you also mentioned that Republicans talk about a safety net, but they never talk about a social safety net. Why is that word social so important?
Because
especially given that, you know, you have a lot of Republicans who love the Margaret Thatcher line that, you know, we don't believe in society. We believe in the
individual. Yeah, there's no such thing as society.
Right. There's no such thing as society. That's right.
You know, the thing is, there is such a thing as a society. And Margaret Thatcher, when she was prime minister, was very similar in who she targeted as voters and what she did. They had a more socialist economy, so she had to do more work to free up private sector options. But she didn't go after the social safety net. I mean, apparently, she kept the Beveridge Report, which is 1943 right. English report that established their welfare state, in her handbag. She knew what the limits were in Britain. And never tried to move against the NHS or the extensive welfare state. She went to free up the productive engines of the United Kingdom. And social is important because we have to understand that citizenship means more than where you live and paying taxes, that people think that being an American means a reciprocal obligation that Americans have towards one another. And some of that means helping Americans out when they need help to make their way in America, whether it's passing an anti-discrimination law or an unemployment insurance law.
So, you know, always talk about, the sort of the three legs of the stool, the social conservatives, the economic conservatives, and foreign policy. Is the fourth leg sort of citizenship conservatives, where they recognize we have sort of an obligation to each other?
Exactly. And that's what draws in blue collar conservatives or blue collar voters to begin to think of themselves as conservatives, is that there are people in American life who are never going to be entrepreneurs.
Right.
Or they may be small businessmen, but they're small businessmen in a way that's not
right.
geared towards expansion.
They're not planning on growing it into Google. I mean, they're small business.
Yeah,
it's a living. They can maybe hire their family. It's an income, but they're not. They don't have. Their plan is not to turn this thing into like a huge enterprise.
That's right. You know, Ronald Reagan said in 1964 that the conservatives represent the forgotten American, which is another Roosevelt phrase that Reagan appropriated. You know, the guy who gets up, goes to work, brings his lunch, pays his taxes, goes to church and knows there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
This is an ordinary person. He could have been, at that time, the Flintstones was still on primetime TV. He could have been describing Barney and Fred.
Right.
Just decent people who supported their families, were involved in their communities, but had no aspirations to rise higher. That's our constituency. But that's not the constituency that the supply side or the businessman want to thing. They want every person to be an entrepreneur, and every person isn't, and you shouldn't expect them to vote for a party that tells them they should be something that they're not.
Democrats have sort of rediscovered the white working class. I think they believe they were not wrong just early on their belief that they need to focus on sort of these rising elements of the electorate, and that eventually would give them victory forever. So now they're refocusing on the white working class, and they think they have an agenda, that sort of an agenda of Medicare for all, free college, breaking up the banks, maybe breaking up the big tech companies. I think that's the new one. They're going after the tech companies, and probably a couple other free things. I don't know. Is that Bernie Sanders agenda? Will that be popular? Since I'm guessing that the next Democratic president will not be Clinton, or candidate will not be Clinton-like, will probably be more Bernie Sanders-like. You can tell me if I'm wrong. Will that be popular?
The Bernie Sanders agenda could be popular depending on circumstances. We basically had a primary among working class voters because most states don't have partisan registration. So a working class person could vote for whichever candidate they wanted. They could vote for Trump. They could vote for Sanders. Most of them showed up in the primaries to vote for Trump. They would prefer a candidate that focuses on the private sector rather than the public sector. They would prefer a candidate that understands that they are facing competition from foreigners living at home and abroad. That's where trade and immigration are linked. And they would prefer a candidate that affirms their cultural viewpoints. They're not strong cultural conservatives, but they're also not cultural liberals or progressives. So on those fronts, they would prefer a Trump to a Sanders. But if Trump is viewed as a failure and your choice is a Sanders and a conventional Republican, absolutely these voters will go back to the Democratic Party and support a Warren or a Sanders that talks about the things that they talk about and downplays some of the other issues that drive them away.
Donald Trump has only been president for 5 or 6 months. What lessons are Republicans learning from his presidency? And whether it's after, three and a half years or 7.5 years, which of those Republican elements will become, primary in sort of the next generation of the Republican Party?
Well, so far the Republican Party is kind of like the apocryphal Bourbons after they've been restored post-Napoleon. They remember nothing and they forgot nothing. They are pushing through an agenda that is, with the exception, when it's revealed, is Ryanism and a combination of Ryanism and supply-sideism and corporate American unmodified. Now, the political realities are forcing that to change somewhat in the Senate. That's what the revisions to the health care bill are doing, is forcing them to accommodate some of these blue-collar voters. But so far, the Republican Party seems to have learned nothing and consequently are setting themselves up for a big fall. Who will become dominant? Well, that's all a question of circumstance and choice, that a prudent Republican leader who understands that there's a majority at hand, if they can seize it, is one that can rise very quickly because they can unite the warring factions of the party. That's what Ronald Reagan did, was unite warring factions in a party and add to it by creating a positive vision. And somebody does that, they'll find that they'll become the next Republican leader.
Do you see anybody out there who you think has sort of figured this out?
Usually you require defeat to figure things out. One of the problems that the Republican Party has had is that they've come back too quickly, that 2010 meant that they felt they didn't need to learn anything. Right. 2012 was followed by 2014. They didn't really need to learn anything. Right. They still don't understand the degree to which Donald Trump's victory is dependent upon people who don't like their core policies.
And that meaning big entitlement reform and big tax cuts for rich people.
Right. You ask these voters, they would prefer. So there's a reason why Steve Bannon is said to be pushing for a tax increase on the wealthy. That's what his voters want. Now, that's only part of the coalition. So Bannon's got a problem there, that he's focusing on the forgotten part of the coalition but forgetting the remembered part.
Right.
But these people would like to see an increase in taxes on the wealthy to fund tax cuts for themselves. These people would like to keep their Social Security and Medicare. These people would like to see restrictions on trade. Now, part of a coalition means that they can't get everything they want.
They can't get nothing. Is that a stable coalition? I mean, as it is, that coalition didn't even get 50% of the vote in this last election. And is that – can that can that win elections, you know, every 4 years? Or is there too much inherent tension? I mean, Democrats are counting. Is there so much inherent tension between that with a supply side business wing and those voters that it's just not stable? And Trump is a one-off because he spoke the language in a way, you know, other people can't, and then they'll all revert to Democrats.
Well, I would point to the states is that governors in the Midwest do not govern like national Republicans. They don't push through massive 35% reductions in their corporate income tax rates and slash social spending to pay for it. They govern, they are in states dominated by Reagan Democrats. They govern in a way to give everybody a piece of the pie, and they win re-election quite handily. I think the National Party needs to look more like the Scott Walker, Terry Branstad, John Kasich Republican Party. And that coalition is extremely stable, and it is a majority of the vote.
And do you think there are interest groups still within the Republican Party that are still so powerful that they will prevent those kinds of candidates from emerging on the national level? They didn't this time, but you know they're still focusing on that agenda of cutting back, or trying to roll back the welfare state, the New Deal, and also again tax cuts, capital gains tax cuts.
No, there are powerful interest groups that are opposed to this type of coalition. I think that what it requires is courage and people who are willing to take risk. And that's what entrepreneurship is about, is somebody who sees a market opportunity that no one else sees and pursues their vision. I think I'm laying out the case for why, basically a business plan for an entrepreneur right. to seize this. And one of the things about American politics is it's so open that you can have most interest groups arrayed against you, but all you need is some venture capitalist to continue the analogy, and you'll be fine. You can, if you've got the right message, you'll find too many people concentrate on finding the money and not enough on the message. You focus on the message in a modern American politics, you'll find enough money to get it out, and then you'll find that you'll get more as the message resonates.
My guest today has been Henry Olson talking about his fantastic new book, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue Collar Conservatism. Henry, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Jim.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.